Hello everyone, welcome to the reading of the Ford Dodge Messenger for Thursday, March 25th. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone, glad to have you listening as always. It's a cool day in Fort Dodge, but at least the sunshine is showing, something we haven't seen for a little while. We're expecting some rain on Friday, and then hopefully temperatures will warm up a little bit. After that, we'll take a more detailed look at the forecast as we conclude our time together. In the meantime, let's go ahead and take a look at our first article in today's Messenger. Regional Trail Survey is underway. That is the first article in today's Messenger. Pathfinder Strategic Partners has launched a trail survey for residents located within the Pathfinder's region. This survey is part of a comprehensive community outreach effort for the Regional Trail Plan. The survey is an opportunity for you to give your input on the current and desired state of the trail system in your city, county, and region. The Region 5 Trails Plan provides a framework to help Pathfinder strategic partners and local governments of the region improve active transportation conditions throughout the region. The plan builds on previous trail planning efforts and consolidates all county and local trails plans into one cohesive plan. It establishes region-wide priorities and provides lists and program guidance which pathfinders, counties, and local jurisdictions can use to help people of all ages and abilities for comfortable walking and biking. The survey can be found at surveymonkey.com/r/region5trails. The survey will be open until April 9th. The survey is available to residents of Calhoun, Hamilton, Humboldt, Pocahontas, Webster, and Wright counties. Homecoming Read is the title of the next article. A novelist with Dayton roots brings latest book to his hometown. The author's talk and book signing by Iowa writer Joe LaValle Wednesday evening at the Dayton Public Library had a different feel to it than book signings usually do. It was more like a reunion for the Dayton native, whose family goes back 5 generations, in the southeast Webster County community. In the photo of the first school being built, there's S.E. LaValle laying shingles. He said, "He was my great-great-grandfather. My great-grandfather Dan was a school bus driver." LaValle currently has 3 books in print, Burying the Lead, Cry from an Unknown Grave, and The Third Side of Murder. Each features fictional journalist Tony Harrington, a reporter at the fictional Orney Town Crier. Except for his latest work set in New York City and Italy, each is set in a small Iowa city called Orney. "It's somewhere out west, somewhere between here and Carroll," he joked. Some of the audience included classmates. "Ties go deep here," he said. "It's wonderful to be home." Joanne Ekstrom of Dayton, who attended school with LaValle as Joanne Nemechek, remembers him well. "I was in his brother's class," she said, "class of 75. She got a signed copy of The Third Side of Murder. "We're getting all 3, she said. "I was so excited to read the stories." She even recognized him in the main character, Tony Harrington. He would listen to KIOA. He liked The Who. That was Joe's favorite band. The first novel, Burying the Lead, focuses on Harrington covering a murder trial and then finding that the person at the defendant's bench isn't actually the murderer. The idea grew from his own experiences as a court and cops reporter at the Globe Gazette. "I was covering a murder trial and I asked myself what might be going on that would cause the wrong person to be on trial. This was in the late 70s and I thought that would be a cool idea for a crime novel." The character in the book went into stasis for a while. "We had just bought a brand new Apple IIe computer," he said. "I got 6 chapters done, then I put it in a drawer for 25 years. LaValle had just retired from a long career in public relations for the healthcare industry when thoughts of his children inspired him to finish the book. "I wanted my kids to be able to say my dad published a book, not that he wrote a novel. I made up my mind to write something every day. I finished it in 4 months and it came out in December 2018. His second book, Cry from an Unknown Grave, takes a darker turn. Harrington battles a group of human traffickers and tries to help their victims. I knew I needed a big topic," he said. "Human trafficking was in the news a lot, and it touches on a lot of social, legal, moral, and philosophical issues. When I started researching, I was overwhelmed by what I learned, It's unbelievable what human beings are willing to do to other human beings. This problem wouldn't exist if there weren't people willing to buy the product. It's people that you go to church with. Even a fictional hero has his limits, though. I knew Tony couldn't solve human trafficking in one story, he said. He's on the trail of a specific group and their victims. His latest book, only recently published, finds Harrington in New York City in Italy. It was time to lighten up and give people some fun again, he said. Well, sort of. Harrington's fictional cousin is murdered in the book. While LaValle has visited both places, research for the book took some modern twists and turns. For the opening chapter, he needed a seawall. I got on Google Earth, he said. Then I began in the north, scrolled down to people and cars level, and went along the coast till I found a seawall that looked like what I had envisioned. That's how it ended up, said Ian Amalfi. LaValle currently has his fourth book in the editing stages and a fifth written. He's being a good reporter and protecting his sources about the plot's turns and twists. I was taught not to share your great writing ideas verbally. I won't tell you how they end, he said. He's still enjoying the process of creating adventures for the fictional Harrington. It's great fun to see where to take him next, he said. All three of his books can be purchased in Dayton at Kelso's General Merchandise on Main Street, and unlike copies purchased from online sellers, each is signed. Also available, an actual reporter's notebook with the logo of the fictional Orney Town Crier. Cheryl Toyne of Dayton had also picked up a couple of LaValle's books during the signing. They're next on her reading list. For sure, she said, they go back a few years. We went to school together, she said. He was 2 years ahead. We were good friends. From Our Files is shown to be next. From Our Files shows a picture of Messenger area players for the Iowa Central baseball team. This goes back to March of 2006, including Matt Schrag of Sac City, Tim Flattery at St. Edmund, Alex Micklow of Manson Northwest Webster, Brian Biesel of Eagle Grove, Adam Birdie of Twin River Valley, and Jordan Miller of Fort Dodge. That's this date in history, March 2006. Magistrate Court in Fort Dodge on Wednesday, maximum gross weight violation, 3 counts, Barry Aiden, 57, of Pomeroy, hearing set for April 14th, voluntary absence from custody, Mark Dugan, 42, of Ames, preliminary hearing set for April 2nd, texting while driving, Sierra Skolin, 20, of Fort Dodge, fined $106.75. Fort Dodge police logs from Tuesday include one domestic call, a suspicious vehicle near South 31st Street and 9th Avenue South. Suspicious person, 2700 block, 5th Avenue South. Suspicious person, 500 block, South 29th Street. Criminal mischief, 400 block, 3rd Avenue South. An assault reported in the 800 block of North 32nd Street. A car accident, 170th Street and Laneson Avenue. And another car accident, 1st Avenue North and North 7th Street. A nuisance, 2700 block 15th Avenue South. Burglary, 3400 block 5th Avenue South. Suspicious person, 700 block of Avenue C. An unresponsive subject in the 1400 block of 1st Avenue North. An assault in the 1200 block of 1st Avenue South. Car accident, 3200 block 5th Avenue South. Trespassing, 100 block North 10th Street. Disorderly conduct, 3000 block 1st Avenue South. A runaway was reported, a suspicious person in the 100 block of South 3rd Street, a fight near 5th Avenue South and South 17th Street, and a missing person in the 100 block of North 3rd Street. That is the news of record for March 25th. The Helping Hand is the title of the next article. One Fort Dodge father has taken what started as a family discussion on ways to spend time together and do some good in the world and turned it into a grassroots initiative to help provide free outdoor spring cleanup services for local senior citizens as well as residents with disabilities or special needs. My wife and I are really trying to look for areas of opportunity that help show our kids how they can impact our community and help other people, Dave Pearson said. Pearson and his wife Danielle have 3 children, ages 9, 12, and 18. He said lately it's been hard to find volunteer opportunities for the younger kids because of COVID concerns and restrictions. Pearson said he and his wife have a soft spot for elderly folks, and they thought offering their services for some spring cleanup would be a great way to spend time together as a family and to help others. It started out with us helping some elderly folks that we knew with their gutters, with some trimming up and clearing their landscaping bed, picking up tree limbs and raking leaves. The projects weren't really about the work, he said, more about building relationships and seeing firsthand the positive impact the family can have on their community. It wasn't long before Pearson decided to expand the service offerings to include those with disabilities and special needs. We thought we have some extra time and resources, so let's make some extra time with our kids and try to help impact others and teach them some hard-working skills, Pearson said. That's kind of how it evolved. When a person or a family reaches out to ask for a spring cleanup help, Pearson goes through an initial consultation to determine their needs, what their needs are, and if the family can handle the job. If it's something that fits and we're able to do it without too much liability, we just round up some people, go over, and take care of what we can, he said. The Pearsons didn't want to make this family project just a one-time weekend thing, so they even took out a classified advertisement out in the Messenger to offer those services to those in need. It started out as a family project, and it seems like it's growing little by little just with people hearing about it, people asking about it, Pearson said. We're hoping to help kind of grow it, the initiative of just helping others and impacting your community. Pearson was brought up with a desire to serve others ingrained into who he is, a trait he and his wife aim to instill in their own children, with this family project being one facet of that goal. It's teaching our kids exactly what we're wanting to teach them, and that is to reach out, serve in your community, help people who can use the help and work hard. Pearson wants to see this free spring cleanup initiative continue to grow, with others volunteering to join his family or to even do a similar project on their own. If we can have some other people who are looking to volunteer for something like this, that would be helpful too, so that we could just kind of help coordinate some work and help people that need it the most, he said. To reach out to Dave Pearson to volunteer or to request services, call 515-571-3840. Again, Dave Pearson's number is 515-571-3840. A Springboard for Success is the title of our next article. Head Start offers early learning option for low-income families. There's a picture of Michelle Carden, who is the executive director of the Your Incorporated Head Start program, poses in a preschool classroom. Carden said enrollment for Head Start was down in 2020. The program continues to serve a high percentage of low-income families and minorities. Carden is hopeful that more children can be served in the coming months. From the article, when it comes to setting children up for success on their respective educational journeys, Head Start is a viable option, particularly for low-income families, according to Michelle Carden. In recent Messenger articles, it's been reported that fewer children have been attending preschool in Fort Dodge, and that children who don't attend preschool are less likely to have academic success later on. Carden reported that enrollment was down at Head Start during the 2021 school year, something she attributes at least in part to the COVID-19 pandemic. We are under-enrolled this year than what we normally are, and part of that was COVID and keeping kids safe, she said, but we weren't available at the office either. With the office closed for several weeks, Carden said that made it more challenging for parents to sign up. Carden believes transportation could be another barrier for families to send their children to preschool, but she said the process of signing up for preschool should be easier in the weeks ahead. Parents come to our central office at 214 South 13th Street or may call at 573-2453, she said. Applications are also available online at hs-ehs.org. Tax information such as a W-2 and a birth certificate for the child is needed. Staff will walk them through what they need to know when they call in, she said. The 3 to 5 year old program is free to parents. Supplies and meals are provided by Head Start. This program, we have to go 1,020 hours. That roughly equates to 6 hours a day for 170 days, Carden said. So they are here for a long time. We have breakfast, a lunch, and a snack, she said. A grant through Linking Families helps provide transportation. We have limited transportation, Carden said. We have a partnership with Pathfinder Strategic Partners. We own the buses, and Pathfinders operates them for us. Routes are available for morning pickup and afternoon drive or drop-off. The 3 to 5 year old Head Start program has been in Fort Dodge since 1965, when Your Own United Resources Incorporated was established as an Iowa private nonprofit corporation, and the mission remains the same. The program is designed to help, quote, break the cycle of poverty, providing preschool children of low-income families with a comprehensive program to meet their emotional, social, health, nutritional, and psychological needs. We have had the same standards since 1965, Carden said. They have some really good forethought on what should happen for children that age. We require a dental appointment in the first 90 days, and it was the same back then. About 100 students attend Head Start at 3611 Maple Drive. A small number of children attend Riverside Early Learning Center through a partnership. Carden said Head Start is a place where children can learn some basic skills in a positive environment. When they are here, we are working on nutrition with them, those social and emotional skills. We work on school readiness skills. We are working with children and families on medical and dental health. Kids brush their teeth here. We work with children on that and finding dentists that will take care of them. We are always working with families to connect them with resources in the community. If a family is struggling to pay their rent, we don't pay their rent money, but we help them find the right resources. About 90% of the children served by Head Start are income eligible, according to federal poverty guidelines. About 62% of children enrolled at Head Start are minorities. Head Start also has a 0-3 program, which Carden said is lesser known. That started in 1999. That's a home-based program that people don't always think about, she said. We have staff going in to work with families, helping families get community resources. That one doesn't have a physical space. Almost 50 families in Webster County are served by the 0-3 program. In addition, Webster County Head Start serves Hamilton, Humboldt, and Wright counties. About 50 people work for Head Start among the four counties. Head Start is a grant-based program. The organization receives federal funding, but a portion of the funding has to be raised locally. We have to raise 25% of our annual funding, she said. Carden said it's about $600,000 that we have to raise through grant funds or any donations. We do get the Linking Families. We can count that as non-federal share. We apply for other area grants. We apply for United Way funding sometimes. In the past, we have had church groups donate blankets and put a dollar amount to that. COVID has impacted the ability to fundraise. This year, COVID has hit differently, so we will fall short, she said. Head Start did receive funding through the CARES Act. That money has gone for things like personal protective equipment and cleaning supplies. We also offered some more training on how to deal with some of the trauma that comes along with children being home for so long, Carden said. The pandemic also put a pause on the foster grandparent program, which Carden said was so valuable to both the children and grandparents. We have a great partnership with the foster grandparent program, Carden said. We are fortunate up until this last year to have a grandparent in each one of our classrooms. It's nice for those grandparents to get here and have that interaction, and it's great for our children. Our staff love having them, whether it's being an extra hand or read a story or listen to a kid read a story. We have had the same grandparents for many years, so it was hard not having them this year. We have really been missing them. Going forward, Carden's hope is that more little ones will attend preschool regardless of where it's at. I want any kid who is preschool eligible to get into preschool somewhere, she said. There's a variety of different setups. There's full days, part days. There are so many options. I would rather see them get in somewhere than nowhere at all. In our next article, Max Yield Co-op and New Co-op to conduct a unification study. The boards of directors of Max Yield Cooperative, based in West Bend, and New Cooperative, headquartered in Fort Dodge, recently announced that they have entered into a unification study between the two cooperatives. Keith Heim, Max Yield CEO, explained how the decision to study the unification of the two cooperatives took shape. In mid-December, I announced my intention to retire from Max Yield, he said. Shortly after this announcement, the new co-op board of directors reached out to the board of directors at Max Yield. They asked if Max Yield's board would consider a joint board meeting to discuss if it would make sense to evaluate what a combined effort of two companies would look like. Heim said that the Max Yield board discussed this request and unanimously agreed that the two cooperative boards should meet. A joint board meeting between Max Yield and New Co-op took place in late January, and on January 29th, the Max Yield board unanimously approved entering into a unification study. The two cooperatives are conducting a unification study to see what a combined effort would look like between Max Yield and New. That is all that has transpired to date. We are having frequent conversations with each other and expect that the study will be completed in March, Heim said. Another question that has arisen after this unification study was announced was that this study is motivated by poor financials at Max Yield. That is absolutely not the case, Heim said. Both Max Yield and New Cooperative are very financially strong organizations. Max Yield has had consistent local earnings, and in fiscal year 2020, we achieved the second best revenue in company history. However, Heim also noted that the agricultural landscape is changing rapidly. Agriculture and agribusiness will continue to change quickly. Technology, communication, and investments in capital projects are leading drivers of this change. The Iowa agribusiness marketplace will look noticeably different in the next 5 to 10 years than it does today, he said. Heim said that the Max Yield directors have an obligation to members to explore opportunities that can be beneficial to its member owners. The board has asked us to see what a combined entity would look like for our members. Things like accelerating how equity is paid out, developing additional grain marketing opportunities, capitalizing on opportunities in the feed business that we don't have today, along with evaluating and expediting capital improvements and accessing additional technology are among the many areas being explored in this study. The unification study and recommendations resulting from the study will be presented to both boards in late March. Max Yield's board will review the study's results and decide on whether to take unification proposal to the membership in the April to May time frame. Heim said if a unification proposal moves forward from the board, Max Yield's members will receive that information in the mail in April. In addition to the member letter in April, we will host member unification information meetings in June and provide information about the potential next steps in this process, he said. Max Yield's membership will vote on the unification proposal if the unification proceeds to that point. If this proposal moves forward, any vote by Max Yield's membership would take place in June, Heim said. We'll take a look next about the Fort Dodge Senior High speech team members as they earn top ratings at state. They prepared 32 entries for the Iowa High School Speech Association District Individual Speech Contest on February 27th. 27 Fort Dodge Senior High performers received Division I ratings and moved on to the State Individual Speech Contest on March 13th. Receiving Division I ratings were Bo Tracy in Storytelling, The Day the Crayons Quit, Braden Schmider, Storytelling, Kate Shelley, Sol Berkey, Storytelling, The Mask of the Red Death, Joey Kelly, Solo Musical Theater, Why God Why, Maddie Vinchado, Solo Musical Theater, Pretty Funny, Reagan Black, Solo Musical Theater, The Song That No One Likes, Lily Johnson, Solo Musical Theater, Naughty. Michael Wagner, Solo Musical Theater, Goodbye. Grace Casiato, Radio News Announcing. In acting, Aaron Amhoff, The Glass Menagerie. Gracie Miller, The Towel Lady. Josh Meyer, A Know-It-All in the Park. Josie Novencito, reviewing Dr. Frost. Improvisation, Dennis Morgan. In reviewing, Ash Wachholz. In improvisation, Valeria Cesaris. In reviewing, Maura Buey nailed it. Isabel Beekman, poetry, Butter to Knife. Destiny Farrett, poetry, I See. Melanie Butrick, literary program, Teen Angst. Britta McCollum in poetry. Sydney Gebers, prose, Presumed Innocent. Isabel Beekman, public address, Every Child Deserves a Champion. Josh Meyer, prose, When Beneath Becomes Air. Amelia Rake, Spontaneous Speaking. Myra Prose, Stone Butch Blues. Sawyer Springer, Original Oratory, Embrace Life. Receiving Division 2 ratings were Nathan Beekman, Radio News Announcing. Victoria Pavic, Literary Program, Emerging. Lily Johnson, Spontaneous Speaking. Ash Wachholz, Expository Address. And Dominique Berry in Prose. Our students spent considerable time preparing their performances, said Lindsay Krug, the Fort Dodge Senior High speech coach. It makes me so happy to see our students achieve such success for their efforts. We'll turn next to the Messenger editorial page. The Messenger editorial is entitled, Correction Workers Are Unsung Heroes. Everyone is well aware that law enforcement officers, firefighters, and emergency medical personnel risk their lives every day to protect us. On Tuesday, Iowans received a horrifying reminder that there is another group of people who risk their lives every day to protect the public. Corrections officers and other prison employees go to work each day to protect us all from the worst elements of society. It is true that there are inmates who change their behavior and use the time in prison to improve their schooling, but some never do. Some always remain dangerous. Unarmed corrections officers and other prison staffers have to deal with them every single day. It is a tough job that lots of people don't want. But fortunately, there are people who are willing to accept the challenge. There are many of those people in the Fort Dodge region. This area is unique in that it has two prisons in close proximity. They are the Fort Dodge Correctional Facility and the North Central Correctional Facility in Rockwell City. And of course, there are multiple county jails in the area. Hundreds of our neighbors work in these prison cells and prisons and jails. They remain committed to the complex mission of protecting the public while at the same time trying to steer inmates toward becoming productive citizens. They do so with the professionalism, dedication, and bravery, knowing that any day on the job could turn violent. These are people who deserve our respect, especially as they mourn the loss of two of their colleagues in the profession. If you know someone who works in corrections, please thank them for everything they do for all of us. And that is the Messenger editorial for today. You're listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. And now we will take a look at today's obituary page. Michael G. Bowen, 62, of Humboldt, died Friday, March 19th at his farm. Services are 10:30 Saturday, March 27th at Deer Creek Trinity Lutheran Church. Burial will follow at Trinity Lutheran Cemetery. Visitation is 4 to 8 Friday at Laufesweiler Funeral Home. In Mike's honor, people are invited to wear their favorite Iowa State University apparel. Michael Gerald Bowen was born April 23, 1958, at Mercy Hospital in Fort Dodge to Betty Cruz and John Bowen. He attended school at St. Mary's in Humboldt through 8th grade. His dad was transferred for his job, so Mike completed 2 years of school in Adel and then graduated from Memorial High School in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1976. After high school, Michael returned to Humboldt and studied criminal justice at Iowa Central Community College, receiving his AA degree. In 1981, he began his career as a rural letter carrier for the United States Postal Service and also worked a second job at Misty Harbor during the winter months. In 2017, after a 35-and-a-half-year career, he retired from the Postal Service. Always a hard worker, Mike had several jobs after retirement, including LifeWorks, Cleary Buildings, and Fort Dodge Ford. On October 23, 1982, Michael was united in marriage to Kathleen Holst at the Trinity Lutheran Church. The couple made their home in Humboldt, where they raised their six children. Starting with his grandfather, father, and Uncle Donald, Michael was raised to be a farmer, passing the lifestyle to his own sons. Michael has farmed his entire life. He was a sport enthusiast that coached his kids and always cheered for the Iowa State Cyclones. He enjoyed hunting and fishing with his sons, Joe and Sam. He liked traveling with his wife and family, but loved trips to the casino, especially when he won big on the Wheel of Fortune slots. Michael also loved typing in all caps. In his younger years, Mike's interests were motorcycles and golfing, but later in life he cherished every moment with his eight grandchildren. Mike was a friend to many, never afraid to talk to a stranger about the markets, the weather, or sports. He will be deeply missed. Michael was a member of the National Rural Letter Carriers Association and the National Rifle Association. Michael is survived by his wife, Kathy, children Jennifer Madigan, Rachel Murphy, and their children Lillian and Drake, Abby Rep, and children Waverly and Sienna, Brianne Hemmer, and children at Bristol and Cyrus, Joe and Bowen, and their children Waylon and Lawson, Samuel Bowen, who's at home in Humboldt, his mother Betty, siblings Stephen, Richard, William, and Joan Bowen. Michael was preceded in death by his grandparents Fred and Ada Cruz, Tim and Sadie Bowen, as well as his father John. He, in lieu of flowers and plants, please consider leaving memorials to the discretion of the Bowen family. From Rolf Lori Mason. Services for Lori Mason will be 10:30 Monday, March 29th at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Rolf. Visitation is 9:30 to 10:30 Monday at the church. Powers Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. William Carlson. William Bill Carlson, 59, of Fort Dodge, died March 23rd at Crestview Nursing and Rehabilitation in Webster City. Bruce's funeral home is in charge of arrangements. Richard Dick Brewer. Richard Dick Brewer, 83, formerly of Fort Dodge, passed away Tuesday, March 23rd in Rochester, Minnesota. A service and celebration of Richard's life is being planned for later this summer in Fort Dodge. Arrangements have been entrusted to Gunderson Funeral Home. Dennis Rapp. Dennis Rapp, 44, of Eagle Grove, died March 24th. Visitation is 5 to 7 Friday at Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove. From Dow's Gene M. Drought White. Gene M. Drought White, 98, of Dow's, died Wednesday, March 24th at the Rehabilitation Center of Belmont. Memorial services for Gene will be held at a later date. And that completes today's obituary page. Heading over to the Messenger sports section, Bill Gree is Fort Dodge personified. From humble beginnings to becoming a professional and philanthropic titan, this story truly inspires. Small world, a story time with a big Fort Dodge connection. The Iowa women's basketball team advanced to the Sweet 16 with a rousing victory over Kentucky on the campus of St. Mary's University on Tuesday in San Antonio. All women's NCAA tournament games are being played at gyms and arenas in the San Antonio region this season due to the COVID-19 global pandemic. Hawkeye freshman sensation Caitlin Clark, who scored 35 points, talked about the friendly confines of the complex at St. Mary's, a private liberal arts college of nearly 4,000 students. I really liked the court, obviously. It was a shooter's gym. I thought it was totally on display. The name of the facility, Bill Greehey Arena. If you don't recognize the name, you should. Greehey is arguably Fort Dodge's most accomplished native son. His fascinating story is one our community needs to know by heart. Hopefully this column helps, given this week's Hawkeye connection to the Alamo City especially. Now seems like a perfect time to tell it. Greehey was born June 1936 and grew up on the southeast side of Fort Dodge. He was the son of William, a mechanic at United States Gypsum, and Mildred, a housekeeper. Bill's two older sisters, Evelyn and Mildred, were longtime Fort Dodgers. Evelyn Wagner was married to Richard Wagner, who founded, owned, and operated Wagner Radiator Shop. Evelyn passed away in 1996. Mildred Kika Lynch, who turns 92 this month, was married to Dick Lynch for nearly 60 years. Dick passed away in 2013. Kika currently lives at Friendship Haven in Fort Dodge. Bill Greehey graduated from Fort Dodge High School in 1954. I grew up relatively poor in a working-class neighborhood in Fort Dodge, Greehey said. Most of the families around us had dads at the mill. I worked there myself part-time from the age of 12 on. Mother did housework to help make ends meet. I was a good student and I wanted to go to college, but it wasn't really an option financially upon graduation, so I joined the service and was stationed in San Antonio. After 4 years in the Air Force, Greehey enrolled at a junior college at San Antonio, thanks to the GI Bill. He then attended St. Mary's, becoming the first of the family to ever go to college, and graduated with an accounting degree in 1960. I parked cars at Nick's Hospital in San Antonio on nights and weekends to support my young family, Greehey said. He has 5 children and has been married to his wife, Lori, for over 60 years. When I got started in college, I loved math. My freshman year, I was thinking about math and physics. Then I took accounting as an elective course. I figured I'd be better off pursuing that career due to the steady income, so I concentrated on accounting for my major and getting my CPA. Greehey quickly established himself as a savvy Texas businessman who succeeded not only because of the decisions he made, but the working environment he cultivated for his employees. He became senior vice president at Coastal State Gas Corporation in 1968 at the age of 32. In 1973, the courts appointed Greehey the CEO and vice president of the struggling Loveca Gathering Company, a subsidiary of Coastal States Gas Corporation. Under Greehey's direction and leadership, the organization rose from the ashes and flourished. Valero Energy Corporation was then created as its spinoff successor in 1980. From 1974 until 1980, I didn't have a single day off, he said. I took over as a CEO of a company that was basically bankrupt. 6 years later, when it was founded, Valero began to take off and ultimately became a great success story. It eventually grew into the largest refinery in North America, with Greehey as the founding CEO. By the time Greehey retired in 2006, Valero ranked 15th on the list of Fortune 500 companies, with $82 billion in revenue and 22,000 employees. Under his tutelage, Valero was twice recognized as the best big company to work for in the United States. As chairman of the NuStar Energy to open the new millennium, Greehey helped forge a new path for Valero. Under his leadership beginning in 2001, NuStar also experienced dramatic growth, exploding from 160 employees in 2001 to 1,600 employees in 2014. From less than $400 million in assets to $5 billion, and from $100 million in revenues to $3.1 billion. In 2013, Harvard Business Review listed Greehey among the top CEOs in the world. I took all the values from growing up in Fort Dodge with me and still rely on them to this day, he said. When I was a kid, we were poor, but I didn't know we were poor. That didn't change the way we treated others. Neighbors supported neighbors. Everyone went to church and looked out for each other. Maybe we weren't blessed with financials, but we were blessed with friends and love. I've always made sure that was the culture we had in our company, caring about our employees and their families, investing in our community and each other. The more you do for your employees and the community, the more you will ultimately be repaid and rewarded. Greehey's business acumen became famous in executive circles, but so did his passion for giving back. The Greehey Family Foundation donates over $10 million annually to various causes and has donated nearly $200 million total since its inception in 2006. In 2005, Greehey's $25 million gift to his alma mater, St. Mary's, resulted in the naming of the Greehey School of Business while funding athletic, academic, and scholarship programs to attract world-class faculty and students. Greehey also founded Haven for Hope, a 23-acre campus that provides a full range of services to the homeless population of San Antonio. The center provides medical, dental, vision, mental health, child care, and detoxification services. More than 400 people live there. Haven for Hope is a private-public partnership with a budget of about $30 million a year. Greehey fueled a $61 million fundraising campaign through San Antonio area businesses to get Haven for Hope off the ground beginning in 2006. 4 years later, the dream was a reality as the $101 million facility opened. According to its website, Haven for Hope has helped 13,000 individuals transition from being homeless to living in permanent or supportive housing. Haven for Hope is my most satisfying achievement, he said. The Horatio Alger Award winner in 2001, given by the Horatio Alger Association to Americans who exemplify dedication, purpose, and perseverance in their professional and personal lives. I'm very proud of everything we've done, he said. At Valero, we've never had a single layoff. Employees always came first. People always came first. So during my transition into retirement, we prioritized the needs of those less fortunate and really emphasized the support of educational endeavors. Even at age 84, Greehey still serves as chairman of the board of New Star Energy LP and New Star GP Holdings LLC in San Antonio. He's usually in the office a few days a week, while also keeping up with the inner workings of myriad philanthropic projects. To me, age isn't a factor, said Greehey, who is in the Texas Business Hall of Fame. As long as I'm physically capable and mentally sharp, I'll be involved in doing the work. When I retired, I wanted to prioritize two things, giving back financially through our family foundation and giving my time. It's the least I can do, being active and present in the community after how good it was to me for all these years. Greehey still gets back to Fort Dodge at least once a year to see Kika at Friendship Haven. His visits were more frequent in the past when he was regularly traveling the country with Valero. My sister is 92, so we try to make sure we see her as often as we can. Time, unfortunately, isn't on our side anymore, said Greehey, who is hoping to be in Fort Dodge again sometime this spring. In the fall of 2018, Greehey helped break ceremonial ground on the Greehey Family Student Success Center at Iowa Central Community College. A $3 million donation from the Family Foundation helped fund the $6 million center, which opened formally in 2020. Junior college was an absolutely critical time in my academic life, said Greehey. I couldn't afford the tuition to go to a four-year school, so I wouldn't be the man I am today without that experience and opportunity. I'm forever grateful for that. If Iowa Central, which exists today, was around when I finished up in high school in Fort Dodge, I probably would have gone there. Iowa Central is an invaluable resource to the kids in and around the Fort Dodge community, and our foundation is proud to support it. Greehey emphasized that the key to success, aside from course working hard, is to have a good attitude. Attitude is everything, regardless of what we're doing or where we're going, Greehey said. It has to start there and never stop learning. It's hard to imagine a better representative of Fort Dodge's relentless spirit, from humble beginnings to the top of the business world. This isn't just the journey of a successful professional, though. Bill Greehey has also prioritize taking care of people with a kind heart and a benevolent soul. The kids of Fort Dodge, our future leaders, should use his story as a template for making a difference in the areas of life that matter most. And this is a column written by Eric Pratt, who is the sports editor at The Messenger. There is no other person Bo Jebin respects more than Rick Sanquist. So while Sanquist has turned control of the Iowa Central softball program over to Jebin, don't expect to see a number of changes made for the Tritons. I couldn't have had a better mentor, Jebin said. Coach Sanquist is an absolute legend in my mind. He coached me back during my high school days. My daughters had the chance to play for him at Iowa Central, and I was blessed to work with him as his assistant. Honestly, we really haven't changed anything from the science down to what we do to prepare. After weather and COVID-19 caused several changes to the schedule, Iowa Central was able to get into a flow of playing by taking on challenges in Minnesota, Kansas, and Illinois before opening ICCAC play with a four-game sweep of Marshalltown. Everything has gone pretty smooth despite all the obstacles thrown at us. The girls really responded like crazy. We have great energy around us and have been practicing hard, cheering each other on even at 5:30 a.m. practices and just really bought in. I'm lucky, though, because not only is it a great group of girls, I have incredible assistant coaches. Cassie Jebin joined the staff in January, taking over the pitchers. A former Fort Dodge Senior High and Iowa Central standout, she serves in the lead role with her dad on the staff alongside volunteers Dale Schnetzer and Kyle Allstop. Cassie was a little nervous at first, but she's really settled in and has been so incredible to have around, Jebin said. I never expected to have her here coaching with me, but I'm so happy it worked out. Dale and Kyle both do this as volunteers and are so important to the success of our program. Sophomores Mackenzie Rosenboom and Abby Thilgis were voted captains and have shined at the plate to begin the season, along classmates Kayla Wookie, Abby Wilson, Allison Stewart, Rachel Newell, and Megan Poole. Kenzie and Abby are both more the lead-by-example types, but lately they have become more vocal, Jebin said. The sophomores have been through a lot with their season being canceled last year and everything else, but they have really been tremendous to have and are helping to get the new girls ready. Among those in the freshman class include former Fort Dodge Senior High All-Stater Logan Schnetzer, ex-Humboldt standouts Carly Thompson and Maddie Lang, Michaela Muir, Layla Pelz, Kristen Rupert, Peyton Crawford, Sydney Vogel, Madison Huseman, and Emily English to round out the group. It really is tough to find the best 10 each game to put on the field with the talent we have, Jebin said. Everybody is pushing each other for playing time, and that's what you want to see. As is always the case, the ICCAC is loaded once again with Kirkwood and Des Moines area ranked in the top 10. The Tritons currently 13th in the nation. It's the best conference in the country, Jebin said, but that is something we've always embraced here. You want to play the best and challenge yourself, and that's what we do with our schedule. The Tritons are slated to make their home debut today, being Thursday, so presumably we'll have a report on how they did in their home debut. As they have done 14 times now in the season, the fourth-ranked Iowa Central volleyball team scored a sweep. The Tritons concluded the regular season in convincing fashion, defeating Southwestern Wednesday in Creston by scores of 25-15, 25-10, 25-22. Iowa Central, 17-3 overall, will be the number one seed in the Region 11 tournament when it begins. The Tritons will host a semifinal contest on Sunday inside Hodges Fieldhouse. Keely Anderson recorded 15 kills, 6 digs, and 2 serving aces, while Angel Baylark had 10 kills and 4 blocks. Ailey Al-Harithi chipped in 6 kills and 5 blocks, with Alicia Johnson registering 27 assists and 11 digs. Southwestern is much improved from the last time we played them, so we were happy to get out of there with a 3-0 win, said Iowa Central head coach Sarah Horn. We could potentially play them again in the semis on Sunday, and they aren't a team to overlook. This will be a great film for us to review and gear us up for regionals. Caitlin Steffes added 4 kills and 7 digs with 3 blocks. Baylon Johnson had 15 digs, Carly Eckert 10, for the Tritons, who have won 7 of their last 8. Our conference is so good this year, Horn said. We have 4 top 10 teams alone, so we are extremely excited and humbled to take the top seed going into next week. The team is fired up, ending the season 17-3 in a year like this. One is a huge accomplishment in itself, but we're ready to get back to work. Isabel West had another 20-20 in the Iowa Central women, won for the 5th consecutive time, downing Iowa Lakes on Wednesday night, 65-56 in Estherville. West, who recently committed to Murray State, scored 26 points and pulled down 23 rebounds, adding 4 steals, 2 assists, and a block shot for the Tritons, who are 9-7 overall. Nevaeh Galloway and Carly West each scored 13 and 13 and combined for 13 rebounds, 4 assists, 3 steals, and 5 blocks. Iowa Central has knocked off the Lakers 7-10 overall. Northeast, Southwestern, Ellsworth, and Southeastern since a loss earlier this month to Iowa Lakes by 5 points. The last 3 wins have all evened the season series with those conference rivals. Jordan Ingbrick chipped in 8 points with Autumn Dykstra scoring 3 and grabbing 5 rebounds. As a team, the Tritons were plus 10 on the glass, plus 7 in second chance points. Iowa Central returns home on Saturday, hosting Southeastern beginning at 5 o'clock. And we'll take a quick look at an article from the Marshalltown Times-Republican. An investigation into a theft took a turn Marshalltown Police Chief Mike Tupper had not seen in his 10 years of serving the department. 2 people were charged with prostitution. John Taylor and Jessica Stanton are facing the charges in Marshall County connected with an incident in February. The police filing states Stanton engaged in a sex act in exchange for money for gasoline. The police filing for Taylor states he admitted the act took place. Tupper said the prostitution charges were filed as a result of the theft investigation. If the latter had not occurred, the other charges would not have followed. It is one of those crimes that is vastly underreported, he said, especially in a community our size. People who are participating in these crimes largely do so in the shadows. It's not out in the open. It's not a crime that we commonly deal with in Marshalltown. Prostitution in Marshalltown is an unusual occurrence, he said, but it is something people should be aware of. Unlike what is depicted in movies or television shows or what people might expect in large cities, Tupper said prostitution in Marshalltown would look different. People are not congregating on a public street. Somewhere in cars are pulling up. If prostitution is occurring in Marshalltown, oftentimes they are occurring out of someone's home or in local motels. Tupper's primary concern when encountered with cases of prostitution is whether or not it involves human trafficking. He said in this case there was no trafficking and were 2 consenting adults. There was no evidence anyone was coerced or forced into the act. Human trafficking is the fastest growing crime and something the Marshalltown Police Department is very concerned about. So far, the Marshalltown Police Department has not had any confirmed human trafficking cases. There have been investigations into allegations. The police department has placed a focus on human trafficking, and officers have been trained to identify signs. That is my biggest concern, to make sure people are not being victimized in this devious way, said Tupper. In this case, there was no human trafficking component, but I think it's fair to say most people don't sell their bodies willingly. Due to the close links between prostitution and human trafficking, Tupper said the latter is something that will be primary concern whenever the former occurs. That's going to be the first thing we investigate to make sure there's no human trafficking. Tupper does not want anyone who is caught in human trafficking to be afraid to come forward and to the police department or asking for help from social service organizations. He does not want a prostitution charge to scare them away. It's okay to come forward, Tupper said. We want to help those people. We don't want them to be fearful of arrest because that would not be our goal in a trafficking investigation. Just because there have been no confirmed cases of human trafficking in Marshalltown does not mean it is not happening. Even though prostitution is closely tied with human sex trafficking, Tupper said human labor trafficking is more likely to occur in a community such as Marshalltown. Marshalltown's location on Highway 30, which has heavy traffic, and its proximity to Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, and Minneapolis can increase the susceptibility to trafficking. It does occur in Iowa, and there have been significant arrests in Iowa, and it is something we should all be aware of. Tupper would like to people to say something if they see something that does not seem right. Trust your gut instinct and call the police. He said, we will come out and investigate, and if it turns out to be nothing, we like those kinds of calls. But if someone needs help, trust your gut instinct. Our time together is quickly drawing to a close, so we'll go ahead and take a look at the forecast like I promised earlier in our time together. So for Friday, we're looking for a high of 58 degrees and a low of 43 with a 70% chance of rain. Saturday, cloudy, 58, 33 Saturday night. Sunday, mostly clear, high of 61, a low of 42. Monday, clear, high of 71. Winds will be a bit gusty. Monday night, low of 47. Slight chance of precipitation. A high Tuesday, 65 degrees under partly cloudy skies. 34 Tuesday night. Wednesday, partly cloudy, high of 52 with just a slight chance of precipitation. That's going to bring us to the end of the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger with a little help from the Marshalltown Times-Republican. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Thanks so much for sharing this time with me. I look forward to the next time when we bring you the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. This podcast and many others are available to you, of course, at iowaradioreading.org, and we encourage you to enjoy our podcast. Thank you for your continued support. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll talk to you again real soon. Bye-bye for now.